SF Signal, episode 193. Where the heck have you people been? This is the Parsec and Hugo nominated SF Signal podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm also an author and a blogger, and my ebooks are available via Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Just visit my website, atfmb.com, for links, or search my name on either site. Now that I've gotten that awkward personal plug out of the way, thanks, John. Well, it's been a while since we've done a panel, and that is entirely my fault. I've been working a job that required me to work a lot of extra hours. That's actually what they call it. Well, they call it ET, extra time. But essentially, it was 50 hours per week, adding the commute time each day and the lunch hour, and I was gone about 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. Sunday through Thursday. Yeah, this resulted in my being A, very tired all the freaking time, and two, pretty much unable to record stuff during the week the way I used to. I had to cram everything into Friday and Saturday, including all the stuff we people do all the time, like grocery shopping, car maintenance, yard work, laundry, and blah, 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 blah. I was busy. And John was tired of hearing about it. Because I've been so busy, Jeff John, not the other John, the other John, Jeff Patterson, John Stevens, and Fred Kish decided to record a special commentary just for you. Well, and for me. Which is going to be our episode this week, and hopefully will be a recurring monthly special event for the podcast that these three guys are going to do. They're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. This week they're talking a little bit about Ian M. Banks. As for me and new panels, as this podcast goes live, I'm starting a new job. I'll be back doing what I did before, which is marketing, and working a regular schedule that should allow me to get back into the groove and start doing regular panels again in the next couple of weeks. 8-to-5 job. Yes! I want to thank everyone for sticking out this odd time in my life and for coming back to listen each week. We really appreciate that. I'd also like to once again thank everybody for the Hugo nominations, and now for the Parsec nomination as well. Both are wonderful, and all of us here who contribute to the podcast really appreciate that you enjoy what we do here. If you've already voted for the Hugos, I hope you remembered us here at SF Signal. If not, there's still time. The 2013 Hugo packet is available for attending and supporting members. Download it, check out all the wonderful nominees, and then, oh my God, vote for me. It's wonderful to be nominated. I mean, it's a huge honor, you know, and I'm sure that everybody in the category feels the way. But oh my God, vote for me. You can also, you know, if you want to, you can vote for them. But after you voted for me. God, this is awkward. All right, take it away, Jeff, John, and Fred. Vote for me.
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and this is a very strange and unusual episode of the SF Signal podcast. I am joined by a couple of gentlemen who I'm going to introduce now. Say hello, Fred Kish.
Hi, this is Fred Kish. I'm with SF Signal, one of the irregulars. I've often appeared on the podcast and in the pages, as it were, electronic. My website is The Lensman's Children. And I'm on Twitter as just Fred Kish.
And we also have with us Mr. John Stevens.
That's me. I am also an SF Signal regular. I have a... It was a weekly column. Now I'm calling it a regular column. I am a writer and a reviewer and a critic and a fiction author. I have a website. It's actually jhstevens.wordpress.com, but it's kind of a lonely place right now because I'm working on a couple of books, but I'm also on Twitter as Erudite Ogre.
Excellent. And as I mentioned, I am Jeff Patterson. I also contribute to SF Signal. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com, and on Twitter I am Jeff Patterson 11. And the reason the three of us are together is because Patrick never did it. In the various iterations of the SF Signal podcast over the years, the three of us have often taunted Patrick for not having the three of us on together, so we decided to do it ourselves, just to tempt fate and also to prove that it was probably a bad idea. So we're going to talk about a couple things tonight. the first thing I wanted to bring up, we are recording this only a few days after the death of Ian M. Banks. And I wanted to personally say that Banks is one of the few authors who I can think of in my life that actually impacted not just my enjoyment of science fiction, but my taste in science fiction. The first culture books that I read, I was not a huge fan of, and for some difficult to define reason, it was probably the third or fourth book of his I read where I finally got it, where I finally understood what it was he was doing. And that had a distinct impact on me, and it actually filtered how I viewed a lot of the science fiction that I read afterwards. It was a definite bar raiser. I love his non-science fiction stuff as well. And it was heartbreaking because, you know, gentlemen, both of you and I, we were all on Twitter talking about this when he first talked about the diagnosis 2 months ago. And it was a profound event to happen over the course of a weekend. And there's certainly plenty of Twitter records of us discussing our memories of him online. But I was wondering if you both wanted to share anything. John, why don't you go first?
It was just so out of the blue. I think it's strange. When he first made the announcement, thought, well, I haven't read a huge amount of his work, but what I read was really amazing, and I wanted to read more, and I had this weird thought that, well, he's, you know, going to be around for a little while, so I'm not going to rush. It was just such a weird thought to have at the time, and then when he suddenly passed away, I thought, wow, I feel stupid. Mm-hmm. Because it was so unexpected, he thought he had much more time than he ended up having. And it was odd that my first response was, the work of his that I've read, I love, The Wasp Factory is actually the first book of his that I read, and for a while it was one of my favorite books, because it's just such a distinctive voice. And the way that he can create a perspective on something, whether it's just, you know, how we conduct our everyday lives or something philosophically profound, was always very compelling to me. And then I read Canal Dreams, and then the first SF of his that I read was Use of Weapons. And I always really enjoyed it, but that weird paradox of, you know, I had more time to read him, as if him being alive was necessary to read him, was strange to me.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet a lot of people felt that.
And then just to suddenly have this happen, I feel really bad. I mean, it's like I said, it's just, I feel really bad now. I've actually grabbed a couple of his books from the bookstore that I work at, and they're at the top of my list to read now. But I feel a little guilty that I'm sort of coming to him more fully now. And reading a lot of the tributes, and also reading people's discussions of his work and the impact on them, I always knew that he was someone who was fairly significant, but that significance seems to be now magnified with his passing,
yeah.
Which happens with some authors, but it seems particularly profound with Banks for some reason.
I would agree with you there. I was actually thinking earlier today about The Wasp Factory and how it was probably, aside from being a stunning first book, it's probably also one of the most emblematic novels of the mid-80s. You know, if you're going to try to encapsulate the aesthetic of the time, I think that book really nailed it. Fred, how about you?
I first encountered Banks with my first encounter on the internet, which was then the ARPANET, on the old SF Lovers discussion board, which I was a moderator of. And Use of Weapons, Consider Phlebas, the early ones were much discussed and much loved. I started rereading his stuff after the news broke, so I've gotten through Phlebas and Player of Games, and I just started Use of Weapons. Less familiar with the non-genre stuff than the genre stuff, because until recently it was just a little harder to get a hold of.
Mm-hmm.
But I've now got everything that's out on ebook. I've got as an ebook, and I've got most of his stuff on in paper as well, including one book that's signed. So.
Ooh.
That I will hold on very, very dearly.
Mm, yes. I had just finished Hydrogen Sonata about 2 months ago, the audiobook for it, and it had ranked up there with one of my favorites by him. I really like Surface Detail. As the culture novels go, I was a huge fan of Surface Detail, but Hydrogen Sonata, thinking back on the story now that we're past everything, is definitely very, very bittersweet.
Well, he's definitely one of the folks that revitalized the whole space opera subgenre. I mean, I was always a fan of Doc Smith and Edmund Hamilton and John Campbell and Jack Williamson, but I mean, in the '70s, that was pretty dead except for Star Trek novels.
Yeah.
Then he came around, and Ken MacLeod and Peter Hamilton and several others, like Baxter's Zeely stuff.
Yep.
That just brought it all back into play again.
I don't think a 2 month period goes by where I don't pull out Look to Windward and read those last two chapters. I just found the paperback of that on a pile of other recent books as well. So, in the course of that, we all talked about ebooks and we talked about the various formats, novels and the audiobooks and stuff like that. And that was kind of what I wanted to talk about. We've had this discussion on Twitter in the past, and we've alluded to it on SF Signal podcast in various ways, but we have all sort of developed, preferences to the format in which we consume our literature, or nonfiction for that matter, whether it be e-readers, whether it be paperbacks, hardbacks, whether it be audiobooks. And we've talked about this before, but something that came to mind in one of the discussions that the three of us were kind of bandying around online was that I've noticed that that relationship that I have with story sometimes translates to the relationship that I have with authors. There are certain authors such as Banks, also Peter Hamilton and Christine Catherine Rush, who I've gotten so used to listening to their books as audiobooks that when I try to migrate that to a different format, whether it be e-reader or physical book, I find it very difficult because the voice isn't there. I actually did a column for SF Signal about this a couple of years ago. But in thinking about that, I started thinking about last year when I moved from Connecticut to Virginia and the fact that I had to jettison probably about half of all my books. And most of the ones I jettisoned, I completely forgot I owned until I got rid of them. You know, as I become older and as I realize that I'm probably not going to be living in my current abode forever, I make my book purchases wisely. And I say to myself, is this something I'm eventually going to give away, or is this something that's going to be part of the cubic footage that I am trying hard not to accumulate here? And I should emphasize that I am talking strictly about prose books. I'm not talking about art or photography books because I am hopeless with those, and I just accept the fact that I will always have this massive mountain of art books to pull around with me every time I move. But what I wanted to ask you guys was, and some of this might be, you know, a rehash of stuff we've talked about before, when it comes to the formats that you choose for particular things, are you looking at practicality? Are you looking at personal preference, or are you looking at some other undefinable thing that I'm not missing? And I'm going to go to Fred first because he reads a lot more than I do.
Well, I am definitely shifting more and more towards different forms of books, specifically ebooks. And that's mostly because I've for years now, I've read them on a Palm Pilot, Handspring Visor, the Sony Klee, the Apple Newton, for crying out loud, and now the Cybook and the Kindle. I mean, yes, there's an experience with the paper. There's an experience in smelling mildew or whatever. But, you know, to me, it's the words and it's what goes on in my mind. And my paper collection has grown until about roughly 10,000 volumes. And I'm just running out of room. I can't buy any more physical volumes. In fact, I'd love to downsize to like 2,000 or less. So for reading, I've stopped buying paperbacks, pretty much. I've stopped buying trade paperbacks, pretty much. And I've practically throttled back completely on hardcovers. Most of my purchases are electronic. Now, for audio, I've been, until recently, selective in buying audio because, until recently, I didn't have a fast connection, so I couldn't really do Audible. So buying CDs was just as bad as buying a hardcover. But for some authors, I definitely find the experience of listening to an audiobook to enhance what I've read previously, specifically someone like Patrick O'Brien and the Master and Commander series. The one narrator I've gotten through, Simon Vance, just listening to the way he would work through the dialogue between the two characters would make me discover whole nuances that I had not known before. So that's my, I mean, I'm buying paper, mostly like you just mentioned, art, comics, some comics, graphic novels, history, and nonfiction. I generally buy paper more than fiction at this point. You know, I'm still going to buy Subterranean when they have a limited edition signed by somebody. I'll still haunt the secondhand shops and the secondhand online stores. I'm not going to give up my signed copy of Psychological Warfare by Paul Lindeberger, a.k.a. Quartermaine Smith. I'm still buying those Cafe Press editions from Harlan Ellison just because I'm not going to find them anywhere else, all this weird stuff he's putting out now. But generally, it's ebooks for me.
Well, it's odd that you say that because it's almost like I categorize a signed limited edition of something. I don't even consider that a book anymore. You know, that is separate from the actual collection. That is not a consumable. That's just an emblem of smugness, if anything else. I look at my stack of signed editions and stuff like that, and I go, yeah, these are probably never going to get read again, but yeah, I got these.
Oh, well, I'll read them. Like I'm reading, or rather, I just finished recently reading Dying Earth by Jack Vance again when the sad news about his passing came out, because that's probably my favorite thing by him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a signed edition, you know, from Underwood Miller, number 500 of an edition of 500. So I don't know how I ended up with it, but I did.
Wow.
And
yeah,
wow. Yeah, but jealous. I want to read it because, you know, otherwise what good is it? You know, it sits on the shelf. If I don't read it, then it's only half the experience.
Wow. Now, Mr. Stevens, I believe you work at a bookstore.
Yeah, so well, let me put it to you this way. I brought 12 books home with me tonight.
Ah!
I'm actually also writing about this for my column this week, as it turns out, because I thought the topic was quite an interesting one to think about. And, you know, thinking about it, at first I wanted to be very sort of cool and, you know, collected about it and try to reasonably weigh all the pros and cons of physical versus electronic format. But what I can realize is that that's completely impossible for me. I am so emotionally and psychologically bound up with the idea of the physical book, with the idea of the codex, and with the idea of the book itself, the idea of the book as a bounded, you know, linguistic entity. It's very hard for me to see... to see the ebook as comparable, even though, you know, I've read a few ebooks. I've reviewed a few books that I've had to review in e-format. It's just not the same thing. It's a different experience to read it in bound form. And I'm sure some of that has to do with sort of, like I said, emotional and psychological attachments that I have to both the idea of the book physically and the actual physical object itself.
Strange, you moved recently as well, too, didn't you?
I did, and I was thinking about what you were saying, and I actually got rid of about 300 volumes out of my library. But I'm sure that since I moved, I have, you know, replaced that number of volumes back into it.
Wow.
I've got about 2,200 volumes in my collection. And, you know, it's some of them are books that I've had for years that I intend to read. Some of them are books that I have for reference purposes. But some of them are also books that I rescue from the bookstore. They're just weird little lost creatures. I have a copy of Young's On Dreams, which I've never read, may never read. But I have it because the first 125 pages were fastidiously underlined, every single line, except for the punctuation marks. And when I saw that come across my desk, I was like, how can I not take this book home?
Yeah, really?
You know, put it on the shelf. Because it's like, so this is the thing. I'm extremely wedded, perhaps a little too much so, to the physical book. But that's because it is so integrally connected to my conception of the idea of the book. I love touching books. I can pull a book off the shelf, and if it's a book that I've read, I can, you know, go back to where I read it, when I read it, what I was thinking when I read it, the good and bad things about it. I mean, I own some books, you know, books on my shelf that I don't like and that I may never read again, but having them for some reason is a little comforting and is also an interesting reminder of the past. So books for me also have a very specific kind of historical life history component to them.
Yeah, that's interesting that that the book as object becomes a separate value from the actual story that it contains itself. Yeah, that's
right. I mean, and
now that you say that, I'm looking at my shelf and I'm saying, yeah, I can't stand that book, but it's still sitting.
Right. I mean, there's also a factor of it's hard for me to read for long periods of time on a screen. And I've tried a couple of e-readers, and the problem does not seem to go away regardless of how high quality the e-reader is. Just looking at a screen for a long period of time and focusing the way that I like to focus on a book when I'm reading a book. And by that I mean like a book that is all one thing. Like if it's a collection of essays, much easier to do. I can read, come back, read, come back. But if I'm actually sitting down and bearing down on a book, like a singular fiction book or, you know, a single subject nonfiction book, I just can't read electronically for a long period of time. It just becomes very taxing. But how much of that is, you know, say a physical problem because of vision, and how much of it is a psychological thing because of how wedded I am to the physical book as a much more relaxing, easily absorbable format for me to read in, I can't really say.
I'm willing to bet there's probably very few people that can say. I think you have to think about it much longer than we do. So, there is something to be said, though, for the ability to carry a tablet or a phone or whatever and know that you have 40 books in there, you know, and suddenly if you're waiting online or you're getting your oil change or whatever, you can whip up the book of your choice from the little bookshelf that you have in the phone, and it becomes an act of convenience, even more so for most people than an act of, you know, cubic footage, as I mentioned, dead weight tonnage that you have to haul around. And I say this as somebody who is married to somebody who's collection of books outstripped mine when she first moved in, which was an act of utter terror, and and the fact that we both had to jettison so much when we moved in. It was also funny because we had lived in our last place for 8 years, and we had moved there, and we never really did a book purging at that point. And as we're purging our books, we're realizing how many duplicates we have that we weren't aware of. It was kind of terrifying. I also had a very odd bit where I would come across a stack of books and I would have to start flipping through them to see if any of them were in fact signed, because I know there's authors that I have so many signed books by, and I'm going, I have to go through and inspect all of these to check. Mm-hmm. Not for page quality, but for, you know, make sure they have not been rendered into something more memorable, less useful, but more memorable. Fred, do you sell any of your stuff, or do you normally, when you get rid of books, how often is that?
I have not done this in several years. Generally, I don't sell them. I generally try to give them away. Mm-hmm. I gave away a couple thousand to troops overseas over the past 3 years or so. And right now I'm looking for a science fiction club or something in the area that would like a large donation. If not, then I'll go to the library. And if that doesn't work, then I'll go to eBay or whatever. But that's just like, that's more work than I really want to get involved with.
Yeah. You know, and Fred, you were the one that got me thinking about magazines and the digest and stuff like that, doing those as electronically as opposed to physically. And it's something that I'm leaning towards a lot more now, because even in the 1 year that I've been down here in Northern Virginia, that pile has gotten, you know,
Tottering.
What quite noticeable, and I remembered how much of those I gave away. You know, I would go through and look for ones that had the only instance of a particular story that I liked, and I was wise enough to steadfastly bookmark them and label them when it said this contains this story by X.
Right.
Now the plague, the thing that plagues me here in Northern Virginia is that I am surrounded within a 30-mile radius by a number of exceptional used bookstores. So every time I'm near one, of course, I just happen to walk in and stumble across something that I need to take home. But I've been pretty good about, you know, quite a few times when I know I'm going to be visiting those stores, I will bring some things to donate or to sell, depending. We also have quite a few very good, library book sales around here as well. So
yeah, our secondhand bookstores are so flooded, I think, because the economy in central New Jersey was so bad for so long that everyone was dumping their books.
Mm-hmm.
And they really don't want any other books. And the libraries, until recently, were kind of not really accepting books either.
Wow.
It's just,
wow,
that's got so many.
That's completely different here. I mean, we constantly buy books. I buy books every day at the used bookstore. And the local library has one of the largest book sales in the country because there's so many books. I mean, I'm in a town with two major universities in a town of, you know, 30,000 people, most of whom are also ex-college graduates who went to those universities. So there's a huge concentration of books here. And yet the circulation of books is really quite high, even with the advent of electronic books being more available. You know, like I said, people do bring in books every day for the reasons that you were talking about, the economy or travel or having to move. But we never really feel flooded.
Wow.
You know, we always just seem to ride the wave.
You know,
I mean, sometimes we'll feel congested. I actually have about 25 boxes of rejects, books that people just abandoned, currently stacked up behind the desk, and then I've got maybe 300 volumes that I have to price. But that's typical. And that'll go away and be replaced and go away and be replaced, and people will buy books, and the circulation just continues.
You know, the other thing that I've been noticing around here is we have a couple, you know, aside from Goodwill and Salvation Army, we have a couple independent thrift stores. And we also have a couple of for-profit thrift stores. We have a Unique and Value Village, which are owned by the same company that runs Savers farther north. And anytime you walk into one of them, their book sections have just gotten unbelievably large. I know when I was living in Connecticut, we would go to Savers, and their science fiction, fantasy, and horror sections were on par with some of the used bookstores that I had seen up there. And that became a source for a lot of volumes, you know, and it's kind of, it becomes kind of bittersweet because, you know, if you have a thrift store that's near you and you go to it pretty regularly, and then you go walk in one week and suddenly there are a whole lot of books by a given author or a whole lot of books of one particular subgenre, and you realize somebody either moved or got divorced or died or something, you know, this one particular stripe and trope of fiction that brought them joy is now suddenly on display now for other people to pick apart. You know, you get a big smile on your face when you find a book you've been looking for or a book you've heard of but you've never actually seen. But at the same time, I kind of get a little bummed when I say to myself, gee, what's going to happen to all my stuff when I'm gone.
Right.
Where are they going to end up? I'm looking at my big stack of the Omni books of science fiction. I think I have 7 volumes of them stacked over there. And I'm saying, oh, someone's going to come across these. And in however many years it takes me to shuffle off the mortal coil and say, gee, I never heard of these. And someone will start discovering Gibson and Sterling and all that. So, and they'll have the, of course I suspect the paper books will be even rarer at that point, but I don't think they're going
to be
time soon.
Yeah, I agree.
Excellent.
And now that we're all depressed.
Yeah. Well, the one thing we had talked about doing on this podcast, which I want to get to now, is we are constantly online suggesting stories or authors or books to one another and praising them and poking each other with sticks, trying to get them to read other stuff. So I wanted to go around and do that. I wanted to find out what you guys are in fact reading, because I think our circles of influence and attention spans and all that tend to differ. So some of us might be reading stuff that the other ones are not aware of. And I thought this might be a good opportunity to sort of point people to actual stories that are getting your attention right now. I want to go with John first.
Well, I've been reading a lot of shorter work, nonfiction, heavy-duty neuroscience. But for the purposes of our conversation here, I actually just finished rereading Robert Jackson Bennett's American Elsewhere, which I'm writing a hideously long review of. It's a great book, highly recommended. And it's what's amazing about it is that in some ways it's very broad, kind of scattered in places, but there's so much interesting detail and things just come together in such a great way, as he weaves in and out of strands and characters, that it really puts a spell on you as a reader. And actually I was going to mention just this morning, I read the latest Daily SF, which comes by email, a story by Ken Liu, City of Chrysanthemum, which was a great story. I mean, I was really impressed. Liu is just such a great writer. And this is definitely one of his better stories.
Is that a subscription? Paid subscription?
That is unpaid. It's free. You just go to Daily SF and sign up, and you get a new story every weekday in your email. And then I think it's 1 week later, it actually gets released on their site.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very distinctive model for publication.
Mm.
And sometimes it's kind of a grab bag. There's great stories. There's terrible stories. But I've actually really come to like waking up in the morning, checking my email, and between all the other crapola, there's a story. There's a new story. There's a new possibility. There's a new thing that I hadn't expected. And what's great is that it's so different than like going through the magazines, either online or in print, because there you're kind of looking for particular things. But like each day, there's something completely unexpected in your mailbox. And today just seemed really auspicious that Ken Liu had a story, and it's a great story.
Wow. I don't think he has any non-great stories.
He has some stories that are just very good.
Yeah, precisely. Those are the days he lets us down. So.
Exactly. It's like, Ken, it's only very good. What's wrong with you?
I need 4.
That's right. I need to be amazed, damn it.
Papa needs a taste. Fred, how about you?
Well, for nonfiction, I'm reading a lot of stuff about Vietnam to the point where I either have to get a degree or do a podcast or run a war game. I'm not sure what.
Well, no wonder you're so depressed.
It's actually very complex subject.
Oh, yes, it is.
For fiction, Jamie Todd Rubin and I are both reading, but he's like, I think at this point on book 3, we're reading the Dark Tower series by Stephen King, which is something I had a lot of experience with King to a certain point that I just got, you know, stopped completely. And now I'm, you know, so many people have recommended that I should, you like that weird stuff. You should read that one. So I am trying to read it, trying to decide whether it's science fiction or fantasy. It's got elements of both. I'm just hoping that I don't end up like with X-Files and The Truth Is Out There or Battlestar Galactica and The Cylons Have a Plan. I hope I don't get to the end and say,
Well, that's part of the excitement of reading. So.
Exactly, exactly.
And my other big project for science fiction is I'm reading a lot of Samuel R. Delaney this year, mostly his essays. So I read the Julian Jaw, which was the first time since the, was it Pocket Books came out with it years ago, or Bantam?
Yeah.
The original trade paperback. So I'm reading that in the new edition, or read that, and now I'm reading Starboard Wine.
Ooh.
And I'm about maybe three quarters done with that.
It's been a while since I read those.
Yep.
Yeah. Did
you see, Fred, that American Shore is actually going to be published soon, reissued?
Of course, right after I buy it. Bought it. I did find. I found American Shore, which is an examination of a single story. So I guess the book is, 50 times longer than the actual story or whatever. I found it in a good edition for a very good price, so I'm very happy. So,
wow.
On the graphical front, I finally spent some of these gift cards I got for Christmas. I didn't know what to do with them. I picked up a couple volumes of the Bloom County series, and a couple volumes of the Prince Valiant reprints.
Mm.
Prince Valiant and the original Flash Gordons are like my two favorite. Just, I cannot believe how detailed newspaper comics used to be.
Yeah, those are gorgeous.
Yep. So that's my snapshot.
Excellent. I got two short stories that I want to mention. One was from the June issue of Analog. It was David D. Levine's Wavefronts of History and Memory. I'm a very big Levine fan. I'm always excited when he has a new story, and that one is particularly good. It's about radio archaeology, people that travel out to where the wavefront of a radio signal would be to try to filter it out from the background radiation, and it's a little drama that occurs over the course of one of these exercises. And he does something which is both wonderful and also annoying, and that is he writes stories that really make you want to see more of that universe. The characters are compelling enough, and the story arc itself is wonderful, but at the end of the day, I say I really want to know how the rest of this universe works. And that's very good. The second one I want to mention is in the latest issue of Interzone, which darkened my door, which is issue 246. And this story was the winner of the, make sure I get the name of the competition correctly. It's the 2012 James White Award winner. And the story is by Shannon Fay, and it is called You First Meet the Devil at the Church Fate. And I'm not going to say anything about it, because figuring out what's going on in the story as it's occurring is one of the joys of it. And when it hit me, I was like, oh, I see what we're doing here. It's a very short story. It's an award winner. It's the last story in the latest issue of Interzone 246, the May-June issue.
Which just showed up on Amazon, because it wasn't there when we spoke about it last.
Ah, yes.
So I will buy it now.
I highly recommend that story. The other ones in there were also very good. I have to give props to Alette Desbaudard has an excellent story in there. Also very good. A very good issue in total, but that one Shannon Fay story really blew me away. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I want to do is I will quite often try to convince other people, especially Fred, that there are comics out there that are worth his while. Something that I do want to mention is last week we saw the publication of issue 12. It's the last issue of volume 1 of The Hypernaturals. Hypernaturals is a comic that was written by Dan Abnett and Andy, why am I forgetting his name?
Andy Lanning. L-A-N-N-I-N-G.
Yeah, yes. Andy Lanning, also known as DNA. They've written a lot of cosmic stuff for Marvel in the past few years. They also did an excellent run on the Image comic Majestic. They did one of my favorite runs on that. And they have just finished the first volume of The Hypernaturals, which is a super team story that takes place in the far future. It is very similar in tone and format to the classic Legion of Superheroes, which has been a DC mainstay about a very large team of superheroes in the far future. But it stands out from just about all the other superhero comics I've read recently in the fact that it takes place in a human occupied Milky Way galaxy, which is very clearly post-singularity. I've never seen anyone really try to tackle AI and nano and quantum intelligence and stuff like that. It is literally the background is wallpapered with this stuff. It is actually the post-singularity culture that they live in is such a character in the story and actually plays quite a bit into the plot. The art is good. It's not hyper meticulous. I mean, the book did come out once a month and it came out on time and the story was enough to really drive you. We see a lot of different planets and there are a lot of different characters with various motivations, both good guys and bad guys. And there is quite a bit of AI, and as usual in compelling stories, there is something going on that not everybody understands completely. And that's part of the mystery of the story. It's going to be coming out in three trade paperbacks. The first volume is already out. The second one, I believe, is due out in July, and the third one is due early next year. But issue 12 just came out, and most comic shops will probably have most of the issues for sale as individual issues. But I cannot recommend that enough for an actual science fiction comic book that uses the trappings and uses it correctly. It's good because you don't get to see comics really trying to keep up with a lot of the tropes that are going on in SF. They tend to take shortcuts and deal with cosmic energies and stuff like that. And this is one that's really been imprinted on by people like Ian Banks and other people that have written, you know, the new space opera and a lot of post-singularity fiction. It actually reminded me quite a bit of Implied Spaces by Walter John Williams. There was quite a bit of that in there in its in its DNA, so to say.
Well, if you look at Twitter, you'll see that I just bought it.
Excellent. I'm very happy. I hope you'll enjoy it. So, I don't like the fact that it's put out by Boom Studios, by the way. I should mention that. We're seeing more and more of a trend of when the trade paperbacks of stories coming out, they're coming out as only 4-issue trades. You know, we used to get the really good, 6-to-8-issue trades that always made me happy, and we're not getting those much anymore, and it's kind of bothering me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have a lot of thinner books when I could have one big one. My wife got me the complete Meta Barons for Christmas, and I'm looking at all my skinny little Meta Barons volumes and realizing I now have to donate or sell these to someone because because I have this beautiful large volume. So I think we've covered all the topics we wanted to talk about. Yep, I hope everybody enjoys this. We're going to try to make this a regular thing, schedule permitting. We're all busy people. We all have things to do. I hope you enjoy it. I hope we'll get some feedback on SF Signal. And a big thank you to both Patrick and John for tolerating us. And hopefully now that we have crossed the streams, the world will not end.
That would be bad.
Yes, it would. All right, guys, you be good.
All right, have a good night.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day. From weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Wah, wah. And scene.